This episode is sponsored by Visible Alpha. While traditional consensus providers offer limited line items and forecast periods, Visible Alpha fills the gap by creating the deepest consensus data in the market with more and higher quality sources and longer-term forecast horizons. Through relationships with over 165 brokers, Visible Alpha sets a new industry standard for consensus data across all of the companies and industries, products, segments, geographies, and more. Rather than digging through the financial models one by one, Visible Alpha extracts data from every line item across sell-side models so professional investors can save time and better understand analysts' expectations on metrics beyond just revenue and earnings. Join our rapidly growing buy-side client base and streamline your investment research workflow so you can focus on generating new investment ideas. Listeners are invited to try Visible Alpha for free by visiting visiblealpha.com/value. That's visiblealpha.com/value. All right. Hello and welcome to yet another Value Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Walker. If you like this podcast, it'd mean a lot if you could follow, rate, subscribe, review, wherever you're watching or listening to it. With me today, I'm happy to have my friend and the founder of Range of Capital, Chris DeMuth. Chris, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having me on, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for coming on for the last podcast of the year.
Have any yet another value swag, though. I love the hat.
You're such a liar. You know it's in boxes right behind you. I know where you are right now. You can go get one later. Yeah,
well,
you can get
one later. I wasn't going to steal one, but anyways, I think the hats are really cool. I will wear one next episode.
Well, thank you for that. The check is in the mail for that endorsement for getting people on the swag.
4 stars.
But let's start this podcast the way we do every podcast. First, a disclaimer to remind everyone, nothing on this podcast is investing advice. That's always true, but probably particularly true today. I think Chris and I have a list of like 8 or so situations and stocks that we're going to jump through. Maybe we'll get to them all, maybe we won't, but everybody should just remember, this is an investing advice. Please do your own work, consult a financial advisor. So all that out the way, Chris, I'll just turn it over to you. Where should we start off today?
Well, we are flush with liquidity with all sorts of things having kind of resolved themselves over the last few months. So looking for kind of new, fresh ideas, we kind of have took big swings, invested probably, I think, in the event fund with the most concentrated book I think we've had in years. But a lot of things are played out. So we've been kind of looking for new ideas, some of which I'm not totally ready to talk about yet, some of which we can talk about. But it's a great time to kind of freshen up. I think my thought when I woke up this morning is no inventory bias. You know, we happen to own some things, we happen to not own things, but that shouldn't make the difference in terms of what we think about next. Going into the new year, kind of just wanting fresh takes on everything. So I've been thinking about merger arb, I've been thinking about litigation, I've been aware of the macro environment, but not something that I really like doing virtually all of my thought kind of firm level. And just thinking about the dynamics for the kind of transactions that work in a changing environment in terms of interest rates, in terms of market dynamics. So thinking about all of those things. How about you?
You know, so one thing, and we've talked about this a bunch on this podcast, offline, all that, you know, I just on the last thing you said, thinking about the things that work in an environment like this, the deals mm-hmm. that work in an environment like this, right? Like 2022 was probably the worst year I've ever seen for, you have a stock that's involved in a process, right? A company that's involved in a process. And one of the things event people do is companies involved in a process. Stock goes from 50 to 60. Event people are going to do a bunch of work on it. And they're going to say, oh, I think if a deal comes through, it's going to be at 70. I think there's 4 strategics. I think it's 80% likely to go through. Downside 50, upside 70, market's got this priced at 50-50. I think higher possibilities it goes through, maybe higher odds, all this sort of stuff. And this has been the absolute worst environment for that sort of stuff because the stock market fell so quickly, interest rates went up so quickly, debt financing fell so quickly that every deal broke, right? And you and I, we'd have deals where it was like, hey, the company turned down a 60 bid hoping for 65, and a month later the stock was 30 and the company was like, what just happened? How did I miss out on this? You know, so I have been thinking in 2023, like, is this the year where is it a year where so much bad happened in 2022? Like, it's just going to be easier to get deals done, and boards are going to be more accepting because they're going to look, and as soon as the debt window cracks open, they're going to say, hey, if we could get to 45, forget that we turned down 60 or 70 6 months ago. Like, let's just get the heck out of here. And, you know, like, are we going to see a wave of deals in this environment, or do things get worse? I don't know. It's tough to put into words, but it's something I've been thinking about.
A disaster for kind of pre-arb takeover candidates. As you say, I've for years and years thought a lot about the subtle differences in how press write about these, and even the wordplay they do when they've actually kind of gotten deals market checked, when they kind of know something's about to be announced. Best case scenario deal gets announced. It typically has been a few dollars beneath what a lot of the kind of analyst community had pegged the deals at. In many more cases, it gets delayed. In many more cases, it doesn't come to fruition, even what I would have considered historically to be a pretty high quality, not just rumortage, but market check deals. Like, a lot of things fell apart this year at the 5-yard line. And it would have been an amazing, I didn't do this, sadly, but it would have been an amazing kind of, probably one of the better short categories this year would have been kind of deal prospect, deal speculations. Just, I mean, just a debacle. And then so many of them not just traded down horribly, but even at that point, I mean, one of my heuristics, I don't know, biases, is that I take pretty seriously corporate buyers that have financing, have, you know, a regulatory route. It's a data point, even if they don't specifically get their deal done, but it's not been a useful data point this year. A lot of things have traded down horrifically and then just kept, like, that initial ARB puke, which I normally scoff at as, oh, ARBs are the worst sellers. They weren't in this year. And this year, a lot of that ARB puke was actually an okay sale price compared to what they did, you know, a month, a week or a month later. And a lot of them haven't recovered since. So yeah, just, I mean, people were looking at a decent number of stocks were takeover candidates at huge premiums where they are now. And if you look at their debt, they're kind of openly speculated to be questionable as going concerns. And just, it's amazing that they were ever serious takeover candidates, even a few months ago, or the market's gotten wrong now, or just things have changed really super dramatically.
Yeah. The two that pop to my mind are Cano Health. Mm-hmm. The ticker there is CANO, mm-hmm. which, you know, 2 months ago was rumored to have a bid from CVS for like $10 to $12 yep. per share. CVS fell through. A couple other strategic buyers said no. And now the stock's trading for like $1 per share. So it's mm-hmm. like, what happened between 2 months ago? You had strategics, you know, this is a very popular space for takeouts. You had strategics that were looking at this and saying, hey, we think this is worth 10. And now it's worth $1 and people are worried they can't refinance their debt. You know, maybe.
And the debt's trading super cheap too. Like, the whole thing is just, yeah, it's a train wreck.
And maybe CVS found something in their due diligence, right? Like, I speculated about this on the blog. Maybe CVS mm-hmm. found something that was like, I hate to use the F word on this podcast, so I'm not going to, but maybe they found like accounting irregularities, or they found some type of stuff where they're like, ooh, we can't touch this. But that certainly didn't come out in the press. It just seemed like they were like, oh, we're worried about the DOJ is already investigating one deal. We don't want to do another. Or the other one I look at is Kohl's. The ticker there is KSS, mm-hmm. where, you know, they had a bid at 70 that I think they turned down. And then they had a final bid at 50 that they ended up turning down. And the bid at 50, like, there was pretty good reporting that a big piece of it was based on financing a lot of the real estate Kohl's owned at $35 to $40 per share, right? That was kind of the implied value. And today Kohl's stocks trades for $26 per share. So not only is it way below all the offers, but it's below the value that their real estate was going to get valued at. It's kind of like, hey, I know, you know, I look at that and I say, is that opportunity? Because yes, the near-term sales is going to suck. Everybody knows 2023, probably a recession. Retail is not in a good space right now. But if you're willing to look, you know, past 9 months, especially for Kohl's, it's like, oh, well, you're buying $35 of real estate for $26. There's an operating business with a long history, a brand, you know, I'm sure the board knows that shareholders are not happy with how they handled the past year. As soon as markets open up, is Kohl's going to be for sale or something?
My guess is that anybody who had a hard year in 2022 who's thinking about a recession in 2023 has almost no time horizon to think about what something could be worth in 2024. And that's a huge opportunity for takeover candidates, because a lot of these do really retrade. And no strategic buyer should have been looking at something this year for something that just a recession. I mean, if you're a strategic buyer, you're going to own it through a recession sooner or later. And just because one's going to hit in the next year, it shouldn't have made the difference. I think if you have a long enough time horizon to see through the next 24 or 36 months, for any investor who thinks they're going to be around in 24 or 36 months, these could be really good, as long as they're going to be going concerned through a tough recession for low to mid-end consumers. And so you have to look at like leverage. You have to think about the cap structure. But if it can survive the next 12 months, probably a lot of these will retrade in the next 24 months.
Perfect. You know, I want to turn to some specific situations, and I just kind of want to start with Activision. The ticker there is ATVI. And the reason I bring Activision up in particular is because we've talked about it several times on this podcast. And earlier this month, the FTC, I don't know if they've officially sued or not, but there was a report that said they're going to sue, right? So FTC is getting ready to sue to block Activision.
They brought they brought a case, and they brought it in front of an FTC ALJ. So it's a little bit of a sneaky process in my mind. I actually have constitutional concerns about whether that is legitimate. It's kind of plodding its way up through the Supreme Court, and that ruling might come not really soon enough for this deal necessarily, but I think it's a really suspicious process for an unelected executive agency to basically refer a case to itself to ask whether it thinks it's right in something. I think that these things should go in front of a judge, a real judge, and an administrative law judge is a sort of grandiose title for what these guys are. They're not real judges. They brought a case. The case was very, very, very similar to notes and thoughts brought forward by Sony's legal department. I mean, this was a kind of a competitor's view. The FTC had two Democrat commissioners immediately signed on. One had this pulled at her conscience for a few hours, and then she signed on to it. So you have three Democrats. You only have one Republican there who opposed it, but it doesn't matter. So they're litigating this, and Microsoft has signed up to fight it. Now, Microsoft, I think they're going to want to stick with this case. They could probably get out of it with their extended walk date. We'll see. And it still comes down, we've not heard back from either the EU or the CMA. CMA being the worst procedurally. However, if you look at substantive gives from Microsoft, and I think Microsoft's been pretty sophisticated about this so far, they've very much lined up with what the CMA has nominally said they're interested in. So if you listen to the CMA and you look at what they're offering in terms of the kind of FRAND, kind of fair, reasonable use of their games, it does seem like it would line up pretty well with what the CMA is asking for. I've listened to a lot of the people at Microsoft talk about this at this point, either very senior people at huge corporations are just kind of like persuasive, charismatic guys, or they're really good. But I listen to them and I'm like, I really think their kind of talking points on this are actually quite genuine in terms of what they're doing this deal for and kind of their interest in mobile and their interest in some of these games. I don't think they have this secret plot screw over one of their platform competitors. I think it would be super dangerous in terms of their relationship with gamers. And, you know, I was just talking with I have a 14-year-old son, and they have various combination of games they like and various consoles at different people's houses. And if one company said, ha ha, we're preventing this one combination, I think that would be a massive blowback amongst gaming customers. I think the individuals who make the decisions at the companies would not really be incentivized to play that game to restrict a console competitor. I don't think that they are trying to do that. If I were Microsoft, I think they have a jujitsu move they haven't played yet, but they've offered what seems to me very, very reasonable, long dated, comprehensive contracts for other platforms, especially Sony. And I also think there's some kind of jujitsu they could play that would harm other Microsoft competitor kind of app store type situation. I think that they could end up with a settlement with the FTC that actually is hugely valuable to Microsoft. There's a shot the company outsmarts them here, but we haven't gotten to that yet. And at this point, decent shot that they're not able to get through the regulatory process.
Yeah, you know, in many ways, it reminds me of AT&T Time Warner, the AT&T Time Warner deal. Now, in AT&T Time Warner, that was all domestic focus, right? Only US, basically, because AT&T pretty much was only a US company, but it's not a perfect parallel, but you had the DOJ coming out and saying, hey, you know, what if AT&T buys HBO and only lets HBO get sold on HBO only gets sold on AT&T devices or streamed out? And AT&T's response was, that makes absolutely no sense. Yeah. Like, you make Game of Thrones, it's a game of scale, right? Game of Thrones is going to cost $10 million per episode, no matter if we show it to one person or 500 million people. So we want to show it to the most amount of people to spread it over the most amount of things. And, you know, Call of Duty is very similar in that it's going to take $200 million to make a new Call of Duty. Mm-hmm. It costs the same, no matter if you throw it on your platform or 100 platforms. And I think Microsoft saying, hey, not only does it not make sense for us to make these AAA game titles exclusive, like I believe the Sony offer was, we'll give them a 10-year contract that says we can't make this exclusive. So it reminds me of that in a lot of ways. I don't know about you, but the thing that really stops me is the arguments I hear from event people are on Activision, two things. One, the downside on Activision. So if it breaks, you know, if Microsoft has to walk, pay Activision, I think it's $3 billion at this point for a break fee. A lot of people say, hey, the market's got the downside on Activision at 60. I think it's 75. So you buy it here at 75, 77, whatever it is, you're basically getting a free upshot of the deal going through. That's number one. And then number two, a lot of people think, oh, they will beat the FTC in court. And I don't disagree with number two. I think they will beat the FTC. I don't really know about number one, but the thing that scares me is number three. I just, UKCMA, we've talked about it so many times. I don't know how you get past that risk. It seems like that's a stopping gate if Microsoft can't get that over the edge. I guess if you think the downside is nothing from here, then you're getting the free upshot. But anyway, I rambled three things. I'll kind of toss it over to you.
I don't like the no downside argument in a bear market. I think just the ability to hand off from ARB accounts to fundamental accounts, you know, now it was a bad month, but I think that in NXPI, that was kind of the last time there was something that was so big and liquid and well followed and well owned amongst people who thought it was probably going to get blocked. There was a, you know, big, in this case it was SAMR, a big Chinese regulatory delay. It looked like it was going to be in trouble, but didn't look like a lot of downside. Ultimately proved to be kind of correct. But it was the time to own it was after the bad news that it's priced in, everything's fine, just the market's not efficient enough at handing these between different kind of accounts. I've been in a few situations where it more or less worked out on lucrative deal breaks, but almost every time you actually have some, unless you're huge, and I think it's different for like prop desks or monster hedge funds that have to move around billions of dollars. But if you just have tens of millions of dollars to move around in a position, you can actually get in on the bad news. And we saw that with Elon's purported termination, right? Like you can actually be pretty patient and lazy about trading these things if you think this, that, then the other thing's going to happen that look nominally bad, and then it'll all work out okay. You can wait. You don't need to set that up ahead of time.
Yeah, and I'm just looking, like, again, Activision was really struggling, right? There were all sorts of issues with a bunch of their different divisions, but I'm looking at the stock price year to date.
And management too.
Sorts of issues, but Activision stock year to date up about 15%. EA down about 10% so far this year. Take-Two down about 45%. The Russell 2000 down about 22%. Like, I look at those and I say, yes, I get you. Like, people like to point out, hey, they'll do, I think they can do $4 in earnings next year. It's a $20 PD. I get you, but it's just hard for me to imagine, based on those peers, that there's no downside here.
I agree.
Yeah. Let's see. What else should we talk about? I know one thing you've been pitching a lot is majority strategics who own majorities of public companies taking out minorities.
Yeah.
I've been pitching it. I guess I'll just throw that out at you.
In a deal market this year where you are pinched between the financing problem of LBOs having a horrible, I mean, it went from horrible to basically dead credit environment for syndicating deal debt. I mean, it'd be, you know, deal, even nominally LBO deals have gotten less and less leveraged. I mean, they've been more BOs than LBOs, and banks have been hanging on to debt. It's been terrible for deal finance. I don't think it's even a horrible credit environment today as much as it's just changed too much. You need to be able to kind of reset, even if things just stabilize at current interest rates. I think we'll be able to do LBOs next year, but it affects prices and it affects so many things, just stops that would have gone forward otherwise as things were in flux on one hand. And then on the other hand, for strategic deals, you have a hyper aggressive regulatory process. What's left? For me, what's left this year has been public subsidiaries or a minority positions in stocks with majority control or majority ownership, where they already have so many of the attributes of a public company that are unattractive, and so many of the attributes of a private company that are attractive, you might as well just take them out. So the things I look for are a majority owner, no need for the public markets, and kind of just having to deal with the public shareholders is kind of an annoyance. You know, you have, if you look at things that have worked this year, just a litany of public controlled MLPs. You have and actually very interesting litigation on that from the Lowe's Boardwalk case. So that just was overturned at the Supreme Court. So it's interesting to look at the advantages and disadvantages in this changing market. It's really changed for having public subsidiary MLPs. And then just generally Turquoise Hill, Continental, a lot of these kind of big money controllers just don't need or want the bother of the public sub. And those have actually, that's probably been one of the smoother categories this year. Of all the things that have been not smooth, those have kind of been working pretty well so far.
No, I completely agree. And, you know, it is one thing that if you own 67% of a company, as if I remember correctly, was about the Turquoise Rio Tinto thing, which we've talked about several times on this pod, like having the other 33% out, especially if it's strategic, if it's got synergies with your business, it just doesn't make sense. Like the public company costs are running $5 billion per year. You take it out, you save that company, you save the hassle, you save the headache. You save having to worry about getting sued for, even if you are doing right by shareholders, like everything you do that you're going to have to get third part, somebody to kind of price it out at arm's length. Like you just save a lot of hassle. It just makes a lot of money. And, you know, add that all in and you've got to market down 20%. A lot of these stocks are down. Like even if you pay a pretty big premium, you can probably like, you'll have happy shareholders because who doesn't like a 30% pop in a down market? And you'll probably be pretty happy because I look at something like you mentioned the publicly traded MLPs, which all got taken out by their majority energy companies recently. You know, Shellex is the one that really pops to mind. Shell went and borrowed at like 4% went and borrowed tax deductible debt at 4% to buy up $4 billion worth of Shellex minority shareholders who are going to get a dividend yield of like 10%. So, you know, they get tax deductible debt to go buy out this thing. They get the synergies from taking out. They lose the headache. Like, it just makes all the sense in the world.
When the first one did it, everybody else must have looked at it and you're like, it's a layup. And those, I think, are very legitimate. You also have a little bit of accounting shenanigans going on with the prospect of sort of like rescuing the narrative on how you got in a situation if something's trading really badly. I mean, this was a little while ago, but there was one kind of retailer that wasn't doing all that well with a huge public equity position in a fund that raised money in a new fund, took the whole thing out, took it private again, and then almost immediately the next day marked it down by like 50% in a fund that had another, you know, 7-year life. But the old equity was at the fund right at the end of its life. So they were kind of very incentivized to make that look good, wrap it up, have liquidity, get themselves paid on every which way, and then kind of deal with the new problems later. And the new problems that ended up being very big problems. But you know, you look at and I've seen a number of these where somebody already has a big position and they're kind of, I mean, it's good money chasing after bad, but it can sometimes be rational from the agency perspective to just kind of clean up messes in the private market versus the public market, and not airing your dirty laundry in public. So they're bad reasons as well as good. With the public MLPs, I think it's good. I think those are actually really good deals for the buyers.
What you just said makes me think of did you see the Weber Bryant BDT deal?
Yes.
Yeah, so for those who aren't following, this was Byron Trott, who's pretty well known among value investors. I believe Warren Buffett once called him like a value investors banker or something. He runs kind of a merchant bank now, and they took Weber, the people who make grills, public, you know, 2021. So outdoor grills are really benefiting from COVID, stay at home, all these trends. They take them public. The stock's down like 90% since they took them public. A couple months ago, he comes in with an offer to buy them out for, I don't know, it was a pretty nice premium. But last week he came in with a definitive offer that was a huge premium on top. And then they reported earnings and the earnings were not good. And a lot of people were looking at it and they're like, why would you take this public? It might be a restructuring. And I think a lot of people say, well, he owns 90% of Weber. They made a massive, massive amount of money on the IPO. If he takes them out way below the IPO price now, like he kind of saves the face a little bit of having to restructure this thing publicly, right? I don't know. Maybe it makes sense, but to me, like, it is a little bit throwing good money out of bad after bad. I'd rather just go through the rational process. But I don't know if I can make an investment thesis on that, but woof, did it work really well for the people who played it?
One of my favorite things about these situations is people who, for years and years, have really positive spins on how they're doing. And so they always have kind of language in the quarterly call that it's very promotional. And then whenever you're in a management-led buyout or in a situation where the target shareholder vote's really in peril, you have these funny dynamics of management kind of like talking down, and many times their tenure and the value of the company, and usually kind of being very nerve-wracking in terms of their description of like all the uncertainty in the future. It's like, hey, do you want to own this yourself? All the terrible things that could happen, you know, you never know about the market and so forth, and not how they ever normally sound, but you have kind of you never really hear them that negative on it other than when they're trying to buy it and take it private themselves. case that I'm looking at right now, Willis Lease Finance have a position on WLFC. It's a great business. It's a kind of multi-generational kind of founder family kind of controller, you know, with the name on the door, very much for better and for worse treated as if it's their company, leases aircraft engines. They pretty much every year try to take it private. It they've had a number of offers. This one, though, is much more structurally serious in that they put together a consortium. They lobbed in a $45 bid. It's trading at 56 right now. I don't think the market certainly doesn't expect it to get done at 45, but they've offered 110% of tangible book value in the past. And so that would be kind of, you know, closer to 70 if they did a deal there. It's really interesting in terms of how they value their inventory. They are super sharp. They know this business really well. You know, they're always doing something clever in their purchases right after the kind of 737 MAX, kind of whenever there's kind of macro general worries, they're always kind of scooping up things for super bargains and then leasing them out. Their stock did, you know, really badly right at the beginning of COVID, but kind of has bounced back pretty well. It kind of was, you know, 60 down to 20, something like that. Now it's, you know, and they've tried to buy it several times. This time they're the most serious. I think it'll probably be, you know, something close to 70, maybe a little bit less than that. But the interesting thing is in terms of book value, in terms of how they do all their accounting, they take the lesser of appraisals, which are generally pretty low, or a depreciation schedule, which always goes down, even in markets where, just because of supply and demand, a lot of these prices actually in the market go up for the first 5 years. I mean, eventually they go to zero. But for a few years, if you have a bunch of engines that people can't get, OEM same day delivery, they'll be trading like twice the value of what they say they're worth. I think if they were trying to like raise equity next, they would be describing their book value at well over $100 a share. There's a lot of different ways. I mean, it's legitimate. It's just like the most bearish, least promotional, it's just the lowest possible way you could get any outsider to value this company.
You know, my favorite thing about this, and I haven't looked in about since the new offer came out, but I've got lots of notes. And my favorite thing about this is, I think this is their third time they've tried to take it private. Mm-hmm. And in this letter, they just said like, hey, bring the old special committee back together from our last few times, just throw them back together and get it going. It's just like they've got the rhythms of how to try to take private down because they've tried it so much. You know, I've never seen anyone just be like, hey, put the committee together again, bring the old gang back. I really like that. And as you said, I do think it's interesting. This time they've got a consortium, whereas the prior two times, if I remember correctly, I don't believe they had committed equity partners. They were just trying to do it on their own. So it does seem like when you get a committed equity partner, it does seem a little more serious because you've probably shopped and talked around to a couple of people. So it does seem a little more serious.
I think so. I think they really want to own this. I think it should be a private company. They don't need the equity market for anything. And I just think that they're good bargain hunters. They're good bargain hunters when it comes to their substantive business. So I think they think about their stock very rarely. And when they do, they're like, hey, I'll buy it for a ton less than it's worth if you want to sell it to me. I think that's true on individual shares. They're good at buying back shares. I think that's true. And it'll be interesting to see how open the consortium is to current public holders who might be able to roll over equity into a private company. I think several might be willing to do that. So that's a really interesting one. But the other thing is, you don't have, you know, we've had these horrific situations of deals busting and buyers walking. But in this case, you're kind of on the same side of the table, and that the buyers in these public subs don't really want to like crap all over the thing and have the whole thing implode. They don't want to go down trade down 50%. You know, even if they don't need the public market, I don't think they want the share price to go to $25 again or something like that. So you a little bit have some, in a tough macro environment, you have a little bit of a less kind of brutal back and forth in terms of bidding. Even people who don't want $45 probably think there should be a deal. Even people who want to get a great bargain as a buyer, a member of the kind of going private group, probably can understand that, okay, this is going to take at least tangible book values, probably some premium, especially given the way they account for it is so on the very low end of what you could say this is worth. I think it's worth over $100 per share. I think they will capture a lot of it, but it's the kind of situation that I really love right now.
And I generally like, in these take privates, I generally like things like airline lessors, injured lessors, everything, where you can point to a hard book number and say, hey, you know, book is 70 and these things that should trade at 1.1 times book, one book, because you generally don't get under book. Like, I haven't seen anybody really... You can, but it's really tough to make a fairness opinion and say, hey, we're worth less than the value of our tangible book. Whereas if you're doing something more earnings-based, you can, A, sandbag the earnings by running a bunch of expenses the year into it. Or you can say, oh, look, we think we should trade towards low end. But saying we should trade for 8x earnings where everything else goes for 10, nothing wrong with that. But going and saying, oh, we think we should trade for below book, like it's just harder for you to pull one over on a special committee, on the courts, all that, when you're doing that.
Especially when they're the decision makers, I would compliment them as very, very good decision makers. They should be worth some kind of premium. This book is a book they put together because they thought they were buying bargains and leasing them out. There is an active market for each of these things. It's substantively what they do. I would say that their pride in the arithmetic enunciation of the value they add is the premium over the book value that they deserve. If the market doesn't notice that, the market's wrong. I think that's why we own the shares. It would be overly humble of them to say, oh, you know, we are worth less than the book value that we put together. We deserve a discount. In normal times, other than when they're the buyer, it'd be hard to get them to, I think they'd be the last people who would make that claim.
I just want to go through one more. We got a couple of questions on iRobot, Amazon. I know this is following closely. You know, iRobot, IRBT is the ticker there. Amazon's trying to buy them. They're the people who make Roombas and everything, if I remember correctly. I think there's a lot of investigation. So I just want to toss that over to you because we got a lot of questions on that.
Yeah, no position, no interest. It's getting to be a more interesting question as it trades down. When it was announced, it was briefly trading really close to the deal price, you know, just beneath $60 a share. We're dealing with a $61 cash takeover, currently $13 spread, which is, you know, a monster IRR if they can get this done anytime soon. I think that we're just dealing with regulators that are just throwing everything at the wall and will not be willing to turn down a hook to go after Amazon. So I think it has, it has all of the difficulty that Activision has in terms of a hook to go after one of the big tech companies. When you look at what the kind of speeches are of the antitrust authorities right now, they really are very fixated on tech and healthcare, probably even especially tech. And so I think that's hard to own here. You know, it gets better and better as it gets closer to, I mean, it's almost back to the pre-deal price. It was trading kind of at 46 right before the deal was announced. So better at 48 than at 59, but I really am not stepping before any of these big antitrust risks right now. Glad I haven't so far. Probably should have shorted it. Didn't. And just from the sideline, kind of waiting on a suit.
I just don't understand the antitrust argument. Like, the one of the arguments that's been thrown to me with iRobot is, you know, they make Roomba, and Amazon's going to take the data from the Roomba, like, that shows the size and shape of your apartment, and use that for what? Like, I really don't understand the antitrust argument. They're they're buying, there are plenty of other competitor, what is it, like automated vacuum makers out there. Yeah. I don't understand. It doesn't seem like this, knowing the size and shape of my apartment, doesn't seem that valuable. It doesn't seem, I don't get it here.
And it's a very ripe for kind of unbranded competition. It's not, it is not a traditional antitrust case. It is a hook for agencies that want to pursue other things with big tech companies. Looking at the history of these, if you really were to succeed in bringing antitrust cases against any of these, and I think iRobot might be even dumber than Activision, but if you're really going to bring all these cases, one of the things that you do, besides kind of making a mockery of the point of antitrust and just benefiting the competitors as opposed to benefiting, even conceivably benefiting the customers, you tend to lock in that moment's industrial organization, right? Like there's throughout the history of these tech platforms, there have been dozens and dozens of different moments in history where it's been very hardware dominant or software dominant or consolidated or separate or startups or private or public. The free market is changing these things all the time. And like nobody really knows what comes next, but it's the agency saying, we're just going to freeze everything as it is right now. It's like, why now? If they had this power 10 years ago, they would have frozen it in that moment. And so I think it's horrible for technology and innovation and just general dynamism, and understates how much people like money and are doing smart things to make it and take share from incumbents in all sorts of structures that nobody really knows about. Like, I can't even tell you who's doing it or how or why. I just bet you somebody is. And because it's happened dozens of times, not just with specific companies coming and going, but dozens of times with the whole structure of the industry changing. And so when people say tech, they imply that it's like these companies now and will be forever. But there's no point in history where the ones that were presumed to be dominant even were relevant necessarily a few years later. I mean, you know, one of the big things that they were concerned about a number of years ago was in-dash nav systems were going to be this antitrust dominance, like the railroads crossing to the West. And this was just right before everybody had nav systems in their phones. I have older vehicles that don't have very sophisticated new dash nav systems. And I always thought when I got them, like, oh, I'm really going to want the new technology in the dash, but I don't even care anymore because I just use my iPhone for Waze. So they never seem to foresee they look at technology, they're skeptical of technology, but they're very obtuse about just the idea of dynamism. The whole thing changes.
Look at the stock prices of all the FANGs this year. You know, look at Google. Everybody knows how great Google's moat is. But until a month ago, I don't think people were thinking about ChatGPT. And then ChatGPT comes out and people are like, oh, my God, this is the greatest threat to Google of all time. I think as it is now, it's a little overstated. But, you know, now you can see a credible thing. And when these things spread, ChatGPT was what? It was the fastest to hit 1 million users thing ever. It did in like 5 days or something. Like, these things spread and they spread like wildfire. And that's why when people say, oh, Google trades for 15 times earnings, Coke trades for 20 times earnings, Google's growing quicker, better cash flow dynamics. Like, yeah, but Coke, like you've got 100-year history. I guess it's Lindy, as the kids say these days. But yeah. Google, you know, when things flip, MySpace at 10 times earnings in 2006 or whatever, the earnings went to zero like that. Whereas a Coke or something, even in a bear case scenario, you're probably getting the tobacco path, right? Where people start really taxing sugar or all that type of stuff. So,
you know, and this FTC would have adamantly been out there defending, you know, locking in MySpace, locking in Netscape, locking in whatever the dominant company was of the day, and would have not ever thought of ChatGPT, which I think is just unbelievable. I've been messing around with it so much. I just think it's spectacular.
Just two quick questions on iRobot. So, sure. That on top of US approval, that has EU and UK CMA.
Correct.
Is especially CMA, is that as big a concern for iRobot Amazon as it is for Activision Microsoft?
You know, I have a great contact who's in front of the CMA on another matter, not this. I don't believe they are actively coordinating, or there's been lots of contact between CMA and the US on this yet. So I don't have any, based on information, there's not that specific worry. Based on judgment, it always makes things a bit trickier if you were going to have some huge bet that they were going to be able to see their way through a tricky regulatory process, because there can always be trading between the US agencies and CMA. Now, CMA and the EU are very, very close, thick as thieves almost always. And the Brits are kind of in a weird situation, and they've kind of replicated all the worst things about the EU in terms of their deal regulator, but still have now a separate process. So it's been really lousy for them. But I don't have specific reason to think that this case has the same problem in practice. In theory, while I'm very happy waiting and being out of this one, if you're taking existential firm risk that you knew this was going to get done because you had a theory about antitrust, you'd always have to, in the back of your mind, worry that there are games these regulators can play. I even think the FTC referring something to the ALJ is a bit of a game. I think that's where the process becomes the punishment and could be even more with the CMA review.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay, cool. Well, hey, Chris, almost been an hour. I'm getting over the flu, so I think I'm going to wrap it up here, but hope you have a great holidays. Looking forward to talking to you before then, but looking forward to having you on again in January, and we'll talk to everybody in the new year.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Hope you feel better soon.
Thanks so much. See you soon, Chris.
Bye-bye.
A quick disclaimer, nothing on this podcast should be considered investment advice. Guests or the hosts may have positions in any of the stocks mentioned during this podcast. Please do your own work and consult a financial advisor. Thanks.